Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
One of my favorite questions in the world is, can I cope? Because fear has a place, yes. And to try to protect us, our brain tends to envision almost like the worst case scenario to try to keep us safe. And so most of the time, whatever happens in reality is not actually nearly as scary or as bad or as difficult as our brain made it out to be. And so as we start to take some chances, as we start to flex our behavior and show up a little bit differently, the question continues to become, can I cope? And sometimes we think we can't, but the reality is that every living human being right now on this planet is coping. And they know that they're coping because they're alive. Like, they literally have everything that they need in this exact moment right now to cope because they're alive, because they're surviving. And so more and more people get to realize that the answer to can I cope is yes. And in the times when they feel like I cannot cope, then the beautiful thing is they get to focus their attention inward to say, what is it that I want to do to increase my confidence that I can cope? And what I love about that approach is that it's not about, I'm going to try to make everybody else different. You know, like the CEO that says, like, can you just fix my executive team? Like, they're broken. You know, they all need to change. I'm good though. Like, that never works. But if everybody could focus on being more self-accountable and more courageous, then we can stop letting fear drive and just put it in its rightful place. Like, I like to say in the back seat, maybe occasionally in the passenger seat if you're doing something really scary, but mostly, like, you can be in the car, but you don't get to drive.
How you dare? How you dare? Today's episode is incredible because we dive into human behavior. One of my favorite things in the world is to study human behavior. In fact, that is the majority of what I do. And Dr. Laura Gallagher, who is today's guest, is a phenomenal observer and thought leader in the space. We discuss her unique method to deal with conflict, her realization that people can work together once they realize how to move past a fear-based culture, and how she's working while traveling all over the world. It's an episode you don't want to miss. I think it's one that everyone from all walks of life needs to listen to, because it applies to work, it applies to family, and it applies to governments. So stay tuned, take notes, and be better. Oh, you didn't think that I was going to forget about the masterclass that I have on the 15th of December that is going to be in the show notes, right? Right. The masterclass is on how to build a career out of your voice, how to use your voice to build a platform, how to turn that into a paid speaking career, as well as whatever comes with that in terms of leveraging your voice into influence. So check out the link in the show notes. For those that can't make it to New York City, like I'm insane, there is an online version, and I can't wait to meet you all. All right, let's get to the episode. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of As Told by Nomads, and today's guest is Dr. Laura Gallagher. Now, Dr. Laura Gallagher is an organizational psychologist and executive coach who founded Gallagher Edge in 2013. She has worked with NASA to change the culture after the space shuttle Columbia exploded upon re-entry in 2003. And with Disney, she's helped them reconceptualize how they do performance management. She has over a decade of experience in creating effective cultures and coaching executive leaders. On top of that, she has spent the last 10 months or so traveling through Southeast Asia, Africa, Europe, and she's currently touring South America. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, the pleasure is mine. I'm infinitely just amazed by what you've done with your career. But before we even get started, I always do this with a lot of my guests. I want you to take us back, you know, take us behind the scenes, you know, let's peel the layers of the onions that do make who you are, and take me back to the early days when you were a young girl and you're thinking about the world. What were the things that came to your mind?
I think that in a lot of ways, I had a very sheltered childhood. So on the one hand, I probably traveled more than a lot of, Americans, if I can say that, because my dad is a pilot. He actually just retired earlier this year, but we were able to fly virtually for free pretty much anywhere. So on the one hand, I did get to explore the world, in a vacation-y sense, you know, with the safety of my parents and my big sister, and we would probably visit the very touristy areas of certain places. I know we went to like Norway because I'm more Norwegian than any other one thing, right? In terms of historical immigration of my ancestors. But I think that I just have incredible privilege, and it's something that I continue to learn about. And I, as much as I did kind of do like traveling with my family and everything, I don't know that I was super into it. I always kind of wanted to get back home, you know, where things were familiar and things felt kind of safer and more comfortable and easier. And it took me a long time actually to get to a point where travel became super exciting and is, you know, as you've pointed out, as currently my life.
Well, you know, something I want to touch on something you said there. You said you've had tremendous privilege. Now, obviously, I'm someone that does a lot of diversity and inclusion, and that comes up a lot in my world when we talk about a lot of that. But can you expound on that? Because you're saying the way you expressed your privilege is very interesting for me to hear, because you said it's something you've had to learn about. What do you mean by that?
So I think, okay, so one of the metaphors that comes to mind for me is, you know, if you ask a fish to tell you about water, you know, they would look at you like you're crazy. Like they don't even understand what you're talking about. It's all they know. And so as, you know, growing up as a white female, straight, upper middle class, safe neighborhoods, I just didn't really know, I didn't realize how privileged I was. It's something that I've had to learn about as I've expanded my horizons and learned more about the world and just understood how many things are sort of like carved out for me because of factors that I presumably didn't choose, although I know that there is some debate among some philosophers about how we choose our lives, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So that's what I mean that I had to learn about it. Like, you know, nobody told me as a kid that I had a ton of privilege. I was very grateful. I knew I had a lot of cool opportunities. I remember meeting some classmates, families, and seeing that they lived in homes that maybe weren't as nice as the home that I was living in. But it really took me, I think probably college is when I really started to understand exactly how privileged I was.
That's interesting. Wow. Yeah. No, thanks for saying that, because sometimes I do come across people who are triggered by the word, right? The word privilege. Sometimes I think the way people have confused the word privilege today is that it means wealthy, you're sitting on a throne, and you're basically ruling over people. And a lot of what we mean in the world that we live in today, when we use privilege, whether it's male privilege, whether it's white privilege, whether it's any of these privilege, it's the fact that maybe you have the luxury of not having to think about extra things, right? So for example, on my end, if I'm a man and I can walk down the street and not have to be heckled past 9 p.m. or any of that, or I don't have to worry about, you know, my safety in that regard or being harassed, that's a certain privilege. And on your end, you're talking about whether it's a system, whether it's not being exposed to certain things and things like that. And that's how the conversation is actually, that's how I have the conversation. So I was just curious to hear what your definition of privilege was when you were saying that. So thank you for sharing.
Yeah. Well, and so, you know, I like that you pointed out that some people feel triggered by it, because I can understand that. And then something that I bring up at times that I fear can trigger others perhaps in the opposite direction is, okay, I'm a big believer in the power of choice and in self-determination. And so whatever life hands you, what do you choose to do with it? So while having privilege makes life easier in a lot of ways. I could also make an argument that it potentially robs people of opportunities for learning and growth and knowing that they can overcome adversity, right? So I have this ridiculous metaphor of like, you know, picture one of those tiny little dogs, right? Like one of these little privileged dogs, and it never even walks. It's like carried around in one of these purses, you know what I mean? Like, and then you put that dog down, you try and take it for a 10-minute walk, and it's like, it can't even do it. It's exhausted. It's out of breath versus, you know, like a spunkier dog that's maybe too big to fit in a purse, or maybe it's small, whatever, size doesn't matter, right? And like, but it runs every day. And so it's hard. And sometimes it's tired and it's exhausted and it's panting, but it's like, it's getting that chance to build strength. So because there are certain things that I think were really carved out very nicely for me in my life, I mean, I think I worked super hard face as many obstacles as other people have faced. So sometimes those obstacles can weigh us down, and then we allow that to kind of be an anchor that prevents us from living the life of our dreams. Or people can take that opportunity to overcome that obstacle, and then they're like, hell yeah, I can do anything. Yeah. So I think there's always sort of two sides of the coin. But because I come from privilege, I always feel a little fearful to, you know, point out that potential other side of it. Because, I mean, yes, I don't have the male privilege that you have, but I have a lot. And I just never want to lose sight of that. And traveling around the world has made it that much more clear. You know, how many people I meet that cannot travel the way that I do.
That's 100% correct. So the biggest trigger that I've seen in my field of work with diversity and inclusion is people don't like the term white privilege. And I have no problem with the term, because it, like, once again, it is something that does exist, and it's something that is just pointing out something about, hey, this is a privilege. And I like how you phrase it. It's also an opportunity. It's not a wall. It's not meant to be this barrier there. It's meant to say, hey, this is a privilege that I do have. What can I do with this privilege to open more doors? That's how I normally reframe those conversations. Because yes, certainly in certain situations, if it's brought out of anger that someone is not used to, maybe someone never has been exposed to that type of anger and they have never seen that thing, and when they're first hearing it, it feels like they're being attacked, I can see how that would cause some people to retreat. But the way that you framed it, and the way that I'm hoping we start to use the word privilege, is that, okay, so now that I've educated myself, how can I follow that curiosity to do something else? How can I use this power that I have, or ability that I have, to create more opportunities? And that's what I want us to do with the world today, in general, in many parts of the world.
Yeah, I completely agree with your characterization of that. And I've actually been on both sides. Like, I've had conversations with people where it did feel like they were very angry, and it did feel like I was being attacked. Mm-hmm. And I'd felt like I was being asked to personally take responsibility for the actions of, you know, our forefathers. And it was like, whoa, okay, hang on a second. Like, I'm just an individual human. I want to understand, and I want to figure out what is possible from here. Like, there is something that still feels like, I don't know, am I meant to apologize for the things that people that I don't even feel like I know have done? Or can I just become self-accountable and, you know, focus on the future and think about what can I create? What kind of impact can I have? How can I continue to use any privilege that maybe I do have to spread more awareness and have an impact and say things even though I don't, quote unquote, have to?
Right. I mean, that definitely makes sense. I understand that. But, you know, they're also, and as you can imagine, I moderate a lot of these conversations. There are moments where I've seen it turn around eventually. But yes, it was a moment of anger, and people feel like, yes, that's my ancestors and all that stuff. And I think a lot of times the anger comes from maybe a lot of people in marginalized communities not feeling like more isn't being done to open those doors, or to actually acknowledge it. Maybe fairly or unfairly, people are expecting people of privilege to say, to stand their ground and to stamp things out and to say no, 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 no. And I do understand that not everybody is called to do that. And there are other times when, especially with what's been happening with Me Too and Time's Up on my end, I remember I added the 21st century gentleman to one of my talks. I basically was saying we need to redefine masculinity. I remember the first time I gave that talk, and I was scared out of my mind because it came out of an article I wrote out of. But a lot of what I learned from that space is, as someone who's also been in a marginalized group and does recognize he has a privilege on the other side, just that I needed to do a lot of listening. And there were many, many situations where I was in where I found myself saying, wow, I'm like taking on the responsibility of all men here. But at the same time, I found that it was more benefiting me listening because I could then understand, one, the anger, and then also just understand where people were coming from. But I did have to humble myself much more than I even thought. And I had to let go of a lot of ego because, there were just certain things that I was saying, man, I could have done more there. I should have done, like, you know, we've all been in situations where someone has said something, why didn't you say anything? And I was like, wow. Yeah. So, but it's a complex situation. That's like a whole podcast episode in itself.
I know, right?
But I did want to address that because I loved how you brought the privilege, and it sounds like you're using that in the best way you can, which is by learning. But I want to continue on with your life. So you travel. Your dad was a pilot, recently retired, but a lot of your life has also been you go into these tough situations to change the culture. Can you talk about what exactly it was like to go into NASA? I mean, I remember when the Shuttle Columbia exploded. I remember I was very, very young then, but I remember when it happened and just kind of what the narrative was around that. So what was that like for you to get into?
Yeah, well, so let's see. Okay, so the Columbia tragedy happened in 2003, mm-hmm. and they did an investigation for, gosh, I'll probably get the time wrong. It was around a year, I think. And they developed something called the CAVE report. So Columbia Accident Investigation Board report. So obviously they went into the details of technically what actually happened with the vehicle, you know, where did the foam fall off of the external tank? You know, at what point in the launch and where did it strike the orbiter, which was the leading edge of the wing. But the, you know, what was most fascinating to me and the reason that I was brought in is because there were multiple chapters that were dedicated to culture and decision-making. So the fact that we have just human interaction that's getting in the way. So one of the things that can come up a lot from outsiders who look in on this situation when they hear some of this is troubling. So NASA had data and information to suggest and borderline confirm that this could be catastrophic. Like, wow. In some ways they knew. There was a lot they didn't know. There was a lot of assumptions, but they had data and simulations that they could run that suggested, hey, it's possible that this could be catastrophic, but they couldn't confirm for sure because there was still some missing information. But there were just elements about how, you know, minority opinions were suppressed. And by minority, I'm not talking about black, white, any of that. I'm talking about, you know, somebody who I'm one person out of 10 who's extremely concerned about this. Certain things had started to emerge as a result of the culture and the systems in the organization where people actually started to fear fighting for their own opinions. It became a situation where, you know, had I been there at the time, I didn't start till 2006. And I was concerned that my boss would like pull me aside and say, hey, Laura, you need to stop. Like, stop bringing this up. You're getting really worked up. You know, my boss is talking to me about it. Stop bothering the program managers with this. And the people at NASA are not stupid and they are not like callous. They care tremendously about the lives of the astronauts and the mission as a whole. And so what becomes so fascinating to me is that you literally have rocket scientists, right? Some of the smartest people probably on the planet, but they can still fall victim to what happens in organizational cultures, depending on how the organization itself is designed and how just human fear affects us in all kinds of ways that we don't realize. So the fear of this might have a negative impact on my career, or the fear of I don't want my boss talking to me like that again, really started to quiet down some of the voices that had the gravest concerns. And so one of the biggest things that I was asked to do was to work with the leaders to give them the skills to create a culture of psychological safety. And that's not a simple feat, because we have just been programmed. I mean, our evolutionary autopilot is fear-based. And I think you know a lot about this. Like, I think you have multiple TED Talks, but I watched one of them and you had this line that I loved, and I might get it a little bit wrong, but it was something like, the more afraid you are, the more dangerous you become.
Yep. Yep.
Like, oh, I was like, yes, that's so true. And, you know, we've evolved to be afraid. Like, literally back in the day, if I thought it was a good idea to go pet that saber-toothed tiger because he looked really cute, it would probably eat me and then I wouldn't be able to, you know, pass on my genes and I wouldn't be part of that chain anymore.
Right.
And so it's like the most fearful humans amongst us that were able to survive and like propagate. And so we are extremely fear-based. And so I think what I was working to do was to say, listen, fear always has a place because there are certain aspects of our world that are dangerous. But for most of us, if we're on autopilot, we're letting fear actually drive the car instead of sitting, you know, quietly in the back seat, speaking up only when it's really required. So like really working with leaders to surface the fears that are getting in the way of them demonstrating the behaviors that we know lead to cultures of psychological safety. So that was my world for about 8 years.
Wow. Yeah. It's like I said, I was excited to interview you because I do believe we're currently in a culture that's very fear-based. And this is not just America. This is all over the world. You've been traveling all over the world. And I grew up in two dictatorships, very fear-based. So you can see the parallels that this does have, this organization type of culture based on fear-based or fear-mongering in the world, whether it's in families, whether it's with governments, whether it's with organizations. And as a psychologist, you study trends, you study people's behaviors. I am fascinated and intrigued to see what you've learned, you know, basically from your environment. How do you feel like we can move past the fear-based narrative or the fear-based mindset and tap into something that's more connective?
So for me, the first thing is figuring out what it is that we're afraid of in the first place. And I love this theory. It's called the fundamental interpersonal relations orientation theory. So it's kind of a mouthful, but it's basically like when we're interacting with other human beings, how do we show up? You know, what are the fears that are driving us in ways that we don't even fully understand?
Right.
And I love the theory because it just gives a framework. The creator of it, Will Schutz, basically said, you know, it comes down to three basic fears. We fear being ignored or abandoned. We fear feeling humiliated or embarrassed. And we fear feeling disliked or rejected. So it's like these kind of three base fears. And if we can establish which one of those fears is driving us at different points during the day, because this is like day-to-day type of fear I'm talking about, we get to uncover whatever bullshit story is underneath that. And sorry, I don't know if I can swear on your show.
You can do whatever you want. You can do whatever you want.
Okay. So because, and I actually was just writing on somebody's Medium article about this morning because I was so into it. Like when we're little kids, we make everything about us, right? Like we don't know any different. And so if our mom or dad is having a bad day and, you know, they snap at us or they make a comment, we internalize that as, you know, we are fundamentally not good enough in some way. We're not smart enough. We're not pretty enough. You know, we're not significant enough. We just don't have enough to contribute. But these become like these unconscious stories. It's like this wiring that shows up in our brains. And then that's driving us on a regular basis. So as cliche as it is, even when I'm working with CEOs and C-suite teams, executives, I ask them to roll back the tape and think about some of the earliest childhood experiences where they felt some of these fears, because we can uncover all of the distortions that are dictating their lives day after day after day. And so that's basically step one. And I'm not saying that's a simple, easy part. It's actually an ongoing journey for me and for everybody that I've worked with. And then the next piece is one of my favorite questions in the world is, can I cope? Because fear has a place, yes. And to try to protect us, our brain tends to envision almost like the worst case scenario to try to keep us safe. And so most of the time, whatever happens in reality is not actually nearly as scary or as bad or as difficult as our brain made it out to be. And so as we start to take some chances, as we start to flex our behavior and show up a little bit differently, the question continues to become, can I cope? And sometimes we think we can't, but the reality is that every living human being right now on this planet is coping. And they know that they're coping because they're alive. Like they literally have everything that they need in this exact moment right now to cope because they're alive, because they're surviving. And so more and more people get to realize that the answer to can I cope is yes. And in the times when they feel like I cannot cope, then the beautiful thing is they get to focus their attention inward to say, what is it that I want to do to increase my confidence that I can cope? And what I love about that approach is that it's not about, I'm going to try to make everybody else different. You know, like the CEO that says, like, can you just fix my executive team? Like, they're broken. You know, they all need to change. I'm good, though. Like, that never works. But if everybody can focus on being more self-accountable and more courageous, then we can stop letting fear drive and just put it in its rightful place. Like I like to say, in the backseat, maybe occasionally in the passenger seat if you're doing something really scary, but mostly like you can be in the car, but you don't get to drive.
Yeah. Wow. I love that. Can I cope? Practice more self-accountability, practice courage, and uncovering distortions. So key. Yeah. And this is all mental work, by the way, for what you're saying. And it's, in essence, is putting the mirror in front of our faces and really asking some tough questions. And the reason why I liked how we started the conversation with privilege is a lot of times, many of us, that the reason why that could be a trigger for us is that sometimes it actually forces us to admit some stuff about ourselves that we might not have, you know, we might not like to admit, you know, whether
yeah.
like you're complicit or you're part of. And it doesn't mean, by the way, this is where it gets into the strong mindset. Just because you've been complicit in the past doesn't make you a bad person, but it does say that you can do more. And then the question then becomes, will you actually do more? And that's where the practicing courage comes into place. And sometimes people don't want to have to even ask themselves that because, you know, the idea that you know you could do more and you're not doing it, it does play in your psyche for sure.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I agree completely. And so I focus on self-acceptance, self-awareness, and self-accountability. And so the self-acceptance piece is, you know, just exactly to your point where you might uncover things about yourself that you don't really like. Okay, so if I do that, if I'm doing that and I don't like it, then I'm going to shut down that process and I will stop learning things about myself and I will stop taking responsibility for things that I actually could take control of. Mm-hmm. And then the process halts. So I actually have this guide that I put out for leaders, and I genuinely think it's good for any human being that wants to like level up in life. But I say self-acceptance is actually the first step. So practicing self-compassion and realizing that, okay, even if I did make a mistake, that does not make me fundamentally a bad person, nor does it take away my ability to transform in the way that I want to. So let me right now in this moment practice self-acceptance. And this is one of the hardest things for a lot of the leaders that I've worked with to integrate. A lot of them have this mentality of, you know, like there's one CEO I've worked with who, you know, he was an athlete in high school. And it's like he would literally deprive himself of drinking water while playing sports until he accomplished something that he thought was good enough. And he thought that that like deprivation and not taking care of himself would drive him to do better. And the problem is that sometimes that would work. And so he taught himself that constantly like putting himself down and beating up on himself was the path to success. But one of the ways I love to help people understand the value of self-acceptance and accepting yourself right now, not later, not once you achieve this or once this thing changes, is like if I was to ask you, do you think that you'll be better as a professional in a year than you are today?
Yes.
Yeah. Like, I hope so, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'd be really kind of bummed, actually, if I didn't get any better at anything over the course of a year. Well, so that means that we are always going to want to be better. We are always going to find ways that we can improve. We can always find ways to level up. So the fact that you can look at something and say, you know what, right now I'm here and I want to be a little bit better, I want to be a little bit higher, that is no reason to not accept yourself right now. That's always going to be there.
Yeah.
And I know this, and you probably do too. You've probably had that moment where you're like, you know what? I'm just going to feel so great about myself once I get this degree, or once I get that TEDx talk, or once I publish this book, or once I hit this many followers. And then you hit those things, and it's like you probably barely celebrate. And
rarely.
Then immediately you're focused on the next milestone.
Yeah. Yeah. Right?
So I know enough of that self-talk where it's like, I used to genuinely believe that happiness would happen when, or, you know, my life would start when. I caught myself saying my life would start after I finished my PhD. And I finished it like 27, so it's not, you know, the latest in the world, but I'm like,
sheesh.
No.
Okay.
I'm living now. I am living now. Like, it's now. And so I feel like one of the most powerful things I can do for people is help them recognize the value of accepting yourself right now, right now in this moment with all of your flaws.
Okay.
Like, be okay with yourself and trust that you will still want to improve.
100%. So I want to ask you a question here. This is a very, every time I get to infuse One Tree Hill here, I'm always happy. Have you ever watched One Tree Hill?
I think I've seen the whole series.
Okay, so it is my favorite show of all time. I have watched it more times. Everybody is always surprised because, but there's one quote. This is the audience is about to roll their eyes. Julian Baker says this one time, and he says, "I feel like people get lost when they think happiness is a destination. We always think that someday we'll be happy. When we get that car or that job or that person in our lives, we'll fix everything. But happiness is a mood. It's a condition. And it's not a destination. It's like being tired or hungry. It's not permanent. It comes and it goes.
Yes.
And that's okay. But if people would think that way, they would find happiness more often." And you said that. I remember I was younger. I was like, whoa, blew my mind. This is crazy. No, my gosh. And then I come back to of course, because I've watched it like over a million times. That is particularly something that I feel like it's just relates to everything you're saying. I didn't mean to break it, Pat. I know you're doing self-acceptance, self-awareness, self-accountability. And I don't think you've gotten to that accountability part, but I just wanted to insert that quote there because people make that mistake with the happiness and they're like, yo, if I get this, that's going to fix everything. And it's, if you really understood what happiness was, you'd just be like, oh, okay.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
All right. I'm actually happy, and I'm not trying to hold myself from experiencing joy until I get something. I'm experiencing it all the way through all my goals.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh. I couldn't agree more. And I don't, that quote didn't stand out to me in particular, but I love it hearing you say it now. And another
Julian
one
Baker,
that I've heard.
Underrated character, Laura. Underrated character.
Amazing. I'll watch the whole series again now. It's on my Netflix here in Colombia. But yeah, like another simple one that stood out to me, and I don't remember the source of it, is, you know, are you in the pursuit of happiness or do you find happiness in your pursuit? Mm. And that's like a regular reminder that I use for myself because I actually believe that happiness is a choice. I'm not saying that's always an easy choice, and I'm actually in favor of the philosophy that I might cognitively choose to be sad sometimes, and that's also okay. But this is kind of getting into that self-accountability piece around choice, is realizing that I have far more choice than was maybe previously aware of. We get so stuck in our heads around all the things that we, quote, should or, quote, should not do, and we let a lot of artificial rules dictate our behavior and our self-talk and our career choice and how we show up in a meeting or how we talk to somebody in a cafe. It's crazy how many things we let influence us and remove from our awareness the fact that I can choose to do something differently here.
Wow.
So I have an example if you want.
No, we are chock full of examples in this podcast. So yes, please.
And I like this example for me. It's I feel embarrassed when I share it because I preach this stuff and I do consider myself to be an expert in human behavior, and I'm still human, right? So I don't get to rise above my human status just because I study human behavior. So, okay, earlier this year, I was in Hanoi, Vietnam. And so I was still working a lot of East Coast hours. I was coordinating with my COO, who has a day job. He actually still works for NASA. And so it was like 7 p.m. his time, 7 a.m. my time. So I've woken up early. I'm struggling a bit with the city of Hanoi. It's crazy. It's also very gloomy. So I'm just not like in my best mental state. And my internet is not working at my home. So I rush to a cafe just to try to get some stable internet so I can have this meeting. And then it starts to rain, you know, like I'm outside and starts to rain. And so then I'm hiding myself under some kind of little tarp or whatever at this cafe. And I finally get on the call. The internet's decent. And then this gentleman who worked for the cafe just starts doing, you know, his normal job, whatever he does in the morning. He's pulling the chairs across this, like, you know, rocky surface of the ground. And it's making the loudest noise. And he's doing this so that he can sweep where the chair was, sweep on the table. And so for every table, it has like four chairs. And so he's doing this over and over and over again. And it is so noisy and it's driving me nuts. And I'm trying to, like, you know, hold my ears and I'm trying to have this conversation and I'm just getting more and more irritated. And, you know, my COO and the other end of the line is like, what is that sound? And I'm like, I am so sorry. Like, just beyond frustrated. So later that day, I was complaining, and I don't love to complain. I actually love to give myself the challenge of like 24 hours, no complaining, and I always have a better day. But I was complaining, I admit it, to somebody else that's traveling with me about the situation. And he said, well, did you ask him to stop? And it just like stopped me dead in my tracks. I was like,
I was thinking the same thing, by the way.
Why? Were you? I like, oh my God. Honestly, it never even occurred to me to ask him to stop. And so I reflected because I can get very, very self-analytical, as you can imagine. And I was like, okay, so why didn't I ask him to stop? I'm like, okay, story's in my head. He's just doing his job. You know, who the hell am I? I'm some American who, you know, barely speaks any Vietnamese, and I'm going to ask him to stop doing his job because I'm basically just using this cafe and paying a dollar for coffee and using their Wi-Fi. Like, so much fear, subconscious fear around why I don't want to ask, why I don't even think to ask. It didn't even occur to me that that was an option. Now, he might have said no, or the language barrier might have been too big of an issue and it wouldn't have been effective to even ask. But the point was, I didn't even think about that as a choice.
Wow.
And that happened to me just like, you know, 8 months ago or whatever. So we all get into these situations where we lose sight of all of the choices that we have, and we allow fear to remove our awareness of the things that we could do. It just becomes like some kind of ingrained rule. And I think for me, and I think for other humans as well, the more emotionally stressed we are, the more tired we are, like the worse mood we're in, the less self-accountable we are going to be. And it kind of goes back to that self-acceptance. Like, do I have peace and calm with myself? And can I look for all of the ways that I could contribute to the situation being the way that I want it to be?
Wow. Yeah.
So that's my recent example where I was like so embarrassed in hindsight to be like, oh my God, I didn't even think about that.
No, I love it. I love it so much. Also, Hanoi is one of the places I've lived in, so I'm very familiar with the, you know, I get, you were describing the humidity. It's one of my favorite places as well. But
was it sunny when you were there, or was it gloomy? Because I only saw the sun one day. And as somebody who's lived my life in the Sunshine State and in Phoenix, Arizona, I really, really need the sun.
You need the sun. No, it was sunny for me because I did it. My youngest brother lived there more than we did because my dad was a diplomat. That's why we traveled a lot. So
okay,
I was there during summers, summer break. So during then it was just hot and humid and we could see the sun. But I'm sure you probably, I mean, it sounds like you went during probably the rainier season or the gloomier.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wasn't there during those periods.
Okay.
So it
rained like every day. I think it was like, yeah,
it does. It does rain a lot, but I wasn't there. I guess the period you're describing, I wasn't there because, I definitely saw a lot of sun. But I just know that, I didn't wear a lot of clothes because yeah. I was sweating instantly. But it does remind me of that. But so what we just heard from Laura Gallagher is self-acceptance, self-awareness, self-accountability. And mistakes don't make you a bad person or take away your ability to transform. Self-awareness is the key to the person you want to be. So that amazing, amazing breakdown, by the way. I love how you broke that all down. I'm curious to even understand techniques that you use to gather information and evaluate behavior. And the reason I'm asking you this, because as a psychologist, sometimes I imagine you're in a room with people that maybe think differently from you, or they have different mindsets, and your job is to sort of, you know, to go into this company culture, interview people, and figure out what the problem is. How can you teach us how to gather information and then observe the trends? Because in addition to people allowing fear to run their mindsets today, I also think there's a problem with collecting information and listening, really listening. So I'm curious if you could share some of your tips.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am very much into individualization or individualism, not in like the collectivist, individualistic way that we often compare, you know, Western society with, say, more Asian cultures, but in the sense of each person is their own person. And I want to meet them where they are. And so when I think about, especially in the context of a team, so yeah, I actually will go and I will talk individually one-on-one with each person on that team before I start working with the team, get a sense of what's going on for them. What do they think is working well? What do they think is not working well? And I ask them a lot of questions that tend to surface assumptions and bring their own awareness to a higher level. Because I think where the power happens is when I bring those people together in a room and I help them with structured experiences to create that psychological safety where they can all just express themselves openly. So I teach openness and I talk about openness. What I mean by that is, how open am I with you when I'm communicating? How much am I distorting reality, or how many of my thoughts and feelings am I choosing to withhold from you? Which, of course, we're terrible at withholding because something always comes out of us nonverbally, and then people make up their own story about what that means. So I teach people how to be open. I give them communication tools and frameworks so that we are less likely to trigger defensiveness in the people that we want to hear us. Because I think that's the biggest thing that gets in the way of our ability to listen. Is subconsciously defenses are triggered, and then we become just like shitty listeners. We become terrible, and we start to just get so inwardly focused. We start to comprise our own answers to things. Miscommunication's happening, and then the other person also becomes a terrible listener, and then they walk away from the conversation thinking, well, that was useless. And then the next time, they don't talk. They just stop talking. And then they start triangulating, right? So like, let's say I have an issue with you, but I don't feel like it works well when I talk to you directly. So then I go to our mutual coworker and I start to talk about you to him, which is completely toxic. And it like destroys trust. And then if you get wind of that, you're going to have a big issue with me. But then the person who told you is going to be like, well, why did you tell her that? Like, it just becomes ridiculous. It becomes so childish. And, but it still happens. It happens in every single team. And it's because we have so much fear to just express ourselves openly.
Yeah.
So I think, go ahead.
You know, I was just going to wrap. No, that you painted a perfect scenario with what's happened today in divisive times. So I'm just curious about those frameworks and how to be open. Because you said earlier, you teach people how to be open and you teach people communication frameworks. Are there some that you could share?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I talk a lot about green line communication, and it just has to do with how I draw the actual diagram of openness. The green line is just a straight, direct line from me to you, or whoever it is that I'm speaking to. And we advocate using the green line versus the squiggly line, which basically represents like bullshit or beating around the bush or, you know, little white lies, you know, distorting, being polite, being tactful. Like, we have a lot of words that we use to try to rationalize not just being open and direct. And then there's withholding. That's like a red line because nothing happens. If I'm withholding my thoughts and feelings, then nothing moves forward. And it's a huge, it stops like problem solving. It creates a lot of toxicity on teams. So the green line means whatever it is that I'm aware of in terms of my own thoughts and feelings, I'm going to share them with you. But I want to do it in a self-accountable way. So when I talk about openness, it's not like if I don't like your shirt, I'm like, I don't like your shirt, right? Or like walking down the street, I'm like, oh, you're ugly. like, oh, those shoes are stupid. Like that's not openness. Mm. Openness is being able to identify the stories in my head that are triggering feelings and emotions in me. So, and like in basic day-to-day communication, if there's no fear in having a conversation, then this part just kind of goes away and that's fine. But where communication really falls apart is when fear gets triggered. So when I talk about the green line, people often want to know, well, like, what does that mean then? Like, if I think somebody's a jerk, do I tell them that they're a jerk? It's like, I would say no. I don't think that's productive. And I don't think it's true openness. That's actually you just showing up defensively. So maybe I think somebody's a jerk because they've been, you know, ignoring my emails for like a week. And so I get really frustrated that I feel like they're ignoring me. So I teach them about the levels of openness and getting it down to at least level 4, which is where I'm open with you about the story I'm telling myself. So I think you had like Tommy Breedlove on your show,
yep,
maybe last year. And I know he talked about Brené Brown. I'm a huge Brené Brown
fan. Same.
We just became
sisters, Laura. I'm obsessed with Brené.
I'm
obsessed. Yeah. So go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. So, and you know, so she talks a lot about this too, like eye makeup, right? So the story in my head, and we all do this, our brain likes to fill in the gaps. And so if instead of saying like, I think you're a jerk because you're ignoring my emails, I can say, hey, I have this story in my head that, you know, you think this project that I'm working on just doesn't matter because you haven't been responding. And an even more open version of that is, I have a story in my head that you think that I don't matter. And I notice it's bothering me that I'm not getting a response from you. Can we talk about why this is happening? And so getting people to level 4 openness requires that deeper level of self-awareness, because some people get really, really stuck in like, no, Bob's just a jerk. He just is. It's like, okay, do you think there's anybody else on the planet at any point in time that ever might think that Bob's not a jerk? Like, let's get off of the idea that this is some universal truth. And let's just realize that this is how you are experiencing him in this moment because of the stories in your head. So I teach clients to express those stories in their minds. And I go back to that FIRO theory framework, right? Like significance, competence, likability. What is it that's getting triggered for me? So I think that I fear that you think I'm not significant because you have not been answering my emails or whatever it is. Now that might sound weird. You're like, okay, who talks like that? but I also encourage toddler mentality. You know, when kids are learning to walk, they fall all the time and they don't stop and feel embarrassed and give up on it because they didn't get it immediately. It's like, yeah, you're going to be a little bit awkward at first, but I like to help leaders transform the way they communicate so they can have these difficult conversations instead of avoiding them. So yes, it might sound weird at first. And then the other piece that becomes so valuable is to make a request. So I have this acronym that I use and it's FRIC, right? So there's a fear or a feeling, which is often going to be like that level 4 openness. You know, I fear you think I am. And then I can make a request of you. What do I actually want from you? It's amazing how often we skip this part in our communication. We just skip right over it. I might bitch at you and complain and say, I don't like this. And you've been ignoring me and like, what the hell? And, you know, it's not very productive. So what is it that I actually want? And so in this case, it might feel simple. My request is that you respond to emails. But even then, like, okay, in what kind of time frame? Or, you know, when is it best to make it a phone call? What is it that I actually want from you? And so often this slows people down as they think about, yeah, okay, gosh, what am I requesting? Because it gets into the space too of like tone, you know, like if I bring something up to you and you speak back to me in a tone and I feel triggered and threatened by that. And then I'm like, ooh, I don't want to talk to him because he used that tone and I didn't like it. It's like, okay, well, what's your request? How can you come up with a request to change the way that you interact with this person?
Wow. Yeah.
So, and being specific about what you want and not saying what you don't want. People love to say, I don't like this. I don't want you to do this. It's a little bit tougher, but it's far more effective to say, this is what I want. And it's a request. It's not a demand, right? So every relationship is co-created. And this is where the I in FRIC comes in. So the I is an inquiry and it's basically always the same. The inquiry is there anything that I can do to make it easier for you to honor my request? It's recognizing that I'm contributing to the situation in ways that I'm probably not fully aware of, and I'm creating space for that person to express themselves for things that they may have been holding back. So like, let's say that I've heard that you've been triangulating, right? Like talking about me instead of to me. And so I say, hey, I notice the story in my head is that you don't really like me and that you're afraid to have open conversation with me because I heard that you were talking to Susie about something that came up in that meeting. My request is that you can speak directly to me if there's something that comes up that you don't like, or if you want to give me feedback. Is there anything I can do that would make it easier for you to talk to me directly? And maybe at that point in time, I learn from you that you actually feel really dismissed when you try to talk to me directly, and that you just decided to give up talking to me directly because you felt like I wasn't ever listening to you. Maybe it's because I wouldn't look up from my computer screen, or I rolled my eyes, or I literally said, like, that doesn't matter, whatever it is, right? And so you get to raise my awareness by saying basically your own request back to me. What do you request of me? And then we can go back and forth as many times as we need to in order to truly co-create and design the relationship and the communication style that's going to work well for us. Mm. And we end with the C for commitment. And so this is where a lot of conversations fall short as well. So if I've made a specific request of you, you can choose to commit to that request or not. And at a certain point, you know, there may be times where you don't want to commit to the exact request I make. Maybe it's a modified version of it. Or if you don't want to commit to the request that I'm making, then maybe we decide that we want to part ways in whatever way that we've had this relationship up until this point. And that's okay. That can be okay. You know, we don't need to always say yes to people's requests, but we're not likely to get our requests met if we don't even ask. So getting to that commitment and being very explicit, I commit to staying really calm and slowing down in my responses when you share feedback with me, because it's important to me that you talk to me directly. Cool.
Okay.
And literally, like, saying that commitment out loud makes me far more likely to actually follow through with it. But it's a practice, most of these things. Changing behavior is a practice. So it comes back to that, like, cycle of, let me practice self-compassion and self-acceptance for where I am in my journey. Let me continue to practice self-awareness. You know what's triggering me to get defensive in the first place. And let me be self-accountable. I don't want to just blame the fact that I was stressed out and that's why I was dismissive of you. Like, no, I am in control of how I show up, and I want to show up more effectively. So I commit to do that. So that's my FRIC framework that I teach my clients to help them understand what it really means to do green line communication.
It's absolutely brilliant. So first of all, what is, just for a recap, F is what?
The F is fear or feeling. Fear. So the fear that I have or the feeling that I'm noticing.
Mm-hmm. And then R is what?
Request. What specific affirmative request am I making of you? What is it that I would like you to do?
And then I is?
I is inquiry. And it's pretty much always, what can I do to make it easier for you to honor my request? So it's saying, I'm willing to work towards this too.
And then commit. C is commit.
Yeah, commitment. What am I actually committing to do as a result of this conversation? Am I going to change my behavior? Am I going to include you more? Am I committing to respond to your emails within one business day, you know, whatever it may be.
Absolute genius, Laura. Laura Gatter. This is it's incredible. The way you broke it down, this is my favorite thing this week. I'm just going to let you know.
That's awesome.
I'm not even just saying that because that's why I asked you the questions as a psychologist. I was just curious how you break down systems, and I'm fascinated with your career because you observe a lot of things and you see a lot of things. And then based on that, you come up with models like this, like, frick, this is freaking good.
Frick, yeah. Thank you. And we love it. We'll be like, frick it out, frick it out.
Man, wow. And I love it. This is incredible. So your goal, we're getting ready to wrap up here soon, but your goal is to penetrate the self-limiting beliefs and defenses that stop leaders from reaching their potential. And you certainly talked about that a lot today, and we definitely want to make sure we give the audience a chance to connect to you. But before we even get to that, can you touch on exactly what you've learned about yourself and the world as you've been traveling? Because you've gone through Southeast Asia, Africa, Europe, now in South America. What have you learned, and why are you traveling so much?
So I am traveling because I realized, probably in college, just how ethnocentric I am. You know, it was my whole world. I actually wanted to go move to Australia first. I went to Sydney in 2013, absolutely fell in love with it. I wanted to go move there. And somebody said, oh, you should do remote year. And I looked at it and it was like, you know, it's basically 12 different countries in 12 different months. And you travel around with the same community of people. And I was like, no, that's not what I want to do. But then a month later, it came up and I started seeing it in my Facebook ads, of course, because, you know, Facebook is terrifying and they know everything about my life.
Oh, gosh. So don't even get me started. Facebook and Google.
I know. And so, you know, I was like, okay, sure, I'll apply. And I just got more and more excited about it. And actually, the person that admitted me into the program was from Australia. And I was like, okay, meant to be. So that's why I'm traveling so much. I'm part of the structured experience. And I don't think that I personally would have put the time into all of the logistics required to do this much traveling if I was expected to do it on my own. So I'm really grateful to Remote Year as a company for offering this and making it, they do make it easier. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
Somebody that, you know, is a nomad and travels around on their own and figures out so much basically by themselves, they're going to put way more time and energy into that. I am still working as I travel. I work at least full time, even though I'm in these crazy places. And so I'm super, super grateful that that's enabling me to travel like that. As far as what I've learned, okay, so I have two more months to go. And sometimes I feel like I'm still in the middle of it. And I would like to be more articulate than I am about what I've learned, but I wonder if it'll become more clear once I stop. You know, once I settle, I'm planning to go back to Orlando, Florida and do more work with my clients there when this program ends. But I think if I'm hovering around insights, it's really two things. One is everything's temporary. Like you even referenced that around happiness, right? Julian Baker, amazing quote, right?
Yes. Oh my
God. Everything's temporary.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's actually really sad and scary for me. And other times, most of the time, I can use that sentiment to be more resilient. So if I'm struggling, if I don't love where I am in a moment, if, you know, I'm feeling down about how things are going business-wise, or, you know, if I've had a fight with my boyfriend, or, you know, whatever it is, like, everything's temporary. Everything will continue to change. And so in the times where I feel down, I know that that's just this moment, and that the next up is right around the corner, and that there's a lot I can do to facilitate that. And then the second big thing is just, holy shit, I am adaptable, and humans are adaptable. Like, when I look at how much I have experienced, and how many, even like just the little obstacles that sometimes they just pile up, we are able to cope with so much more than we realize. And it does take a lot of energy. So I'm not going to say that I can just adapt and it's like nothing. And being in these foreign countries is just the same as being in Orlando, where I was living for 13 years. It's not. There are a ton of things that are much, much easier about being in Orlando, but I can do it. And so in the same way that at the beginning of our conversation, I alluded to sometimes, you know, not having as much privilege or having obstacles to overcome in life actually create strength in you, because you get to see like, holy shit, if I can deal with that, I can take on anything. And so the adaptability piece, I think, continues to give me courage. Like when I started on this experience traveling, I actually did not know what I was going to do for revenue. I was like, I'll figure it out. And I'm still figuring it out. You know, it's not like perfect. It hasn't all been completely magical. It's been a lot of hard work and brand new worlds. But pure adaptability. Like, I wish that every human on this planet could know just how much they actually can handle, because I think we would all become so much more courageous. We would all speak the ideas that we have, you know, because I believe that humans are good and that we want to have a positive impact, but we allow the fear of, you know, will somebody judge me? And you know what? They're always going to judge you. So screw it. Just yeah. Do you. I think if we realized how resilient and adaptable we are as humans, the world would genuinely be a better place. Not to end with like the cheesiest line ever, but I do believe.
I love that. And I love your story so much. And for those listening, it's the program she's with, she referenced, Remote Year, rather, which is a program founded by Greg Kaplan, who was episode 383. So check that out if you're really interested in being part of the program. But as you can see, I always love full circle moments. Dr. Gallagher here is someone that's gone through the program, and she does attest to the fact that it makes things easier. I love the adaptability aspect of yourself as well, because you talk about the fact that you found that you're more adaptability. You wanted to push out of your ethnocentrism, and the awareness of the fact that you've gone through a lot has made you even be more courageous. I think those are reminders that we ourselves as humans have to have. And then you end it with the fact that we're inherently good. And that's a very, very brave thing to actually say in today's world. But the fact that we're inherently good should inspire some sort of bravery in people to say, how can we get you back to what I know you're inherently there? I mean, it's so much easier to react out of fear and hate and ignorance, but love is intrinsically bigger than fear. And so it's something that we need to remind ourselves that we're capable of. And that's the work. That's why it's hard work, but that is the work that we have to do.
That was fantastic. I loved your capture and your summary there.
Thank you so much. How can people reach out to you, and what type of clients do you normally work with?
People can reach out to me. I think the best way, actually, I would recommend going to GallagherEdge.com/3steps, the number 3 steps. So like, if they want to learn more and kind of get a step-by-step guide of how to put some of this stuff into practice, like self-acceptance, self-awareness, self-accountability, I would love you to check that out. Give me your feedback. Like, let me know if it makes sense to you. And then as far as clients, you know, I it's really psychographic for me. I love working with leaders who care a lot about company culture, mm-hmm. and they're super driven, like absolutely determined to figure things out, and courageous enough to look inward. That's the kind of person I love to work with.
Oh, well, I certainly hope that we were able to get you in front of those people.
I hope so too.
This podcast is definitely going to be heard by a lot of people, so I'm going to make sure we continue to get that there. And then the website, by the way, will be in the show notes, and I'll also put the link to you know, the resource that you mentioned earlier. So we'll make sure we leave no stones unturned for you.
That's perfect. Thank you.
No problem. The last question I always ask my guests is this, and that's my mission statement. So my mission statement is, use your difference to make a difference. It's the foundation of everything I do. It's why I wake up, and it's why I'm inspired to do what I do with my voice or with diversity and inclusion. So I'm curious, Laura, Dr. Galler, how do you use your difference to make a difference?
I think one of the things that makes me different is that I'm genuinely obsessed with self-awareness. Mm-hmm. And so I know Brené Brown talks about, like, researcher, heal thyself. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very much true for me. So I think part of what makes me different is, A, the obsession with self-awareness, and B, as I continue to practice self-acceptance, I am so not afraid to put myself out there as, you know, an example of what is often wrong with the world, because we all have that in us. So it's that vulnerability to say, yeah, I am super far from perfect. I am actually a recovering perfectionist. And I think that the more that I can show that, yes, even somebody like me who studies this stuff, it's still a journey for me. And my hope is that I can make all of this stuff a lot more accessible to people who currently feel too afraid to look inward to that degree.
Wow. Wow. Your obsession with self-awareness is what drives you. And it is truly, that's incredible. I love that so much. Thank you so much for spending all this time with us. Thank you for, you know, breaking things down with me. Thank you for sharing that love for One Tree Hill with me and and Brené Brown. You know, I do miss One Tree Hill a lot. So every time I get to, you know, use a
reunion show, right? Like, they could come back and get that started again.
I saw they did a reunion on Lifetime. Don't ask me why I was watching Lifetime. So first of all, they had like a big reunion because there was a bunch of the cast were in a particular Christmas movie, and I love Christmas movies, and they all came there, and I was like, I'm watching this right now.
Oh, that's so awesome.
But thank you, Laura, for indulging me in that. And I can't wait to get this episode out. Looking forward to hearing more about what you learned and sharing that with the world.
Thank you. It was really my pleasure.
Pleasure is mine. And ladies and gentlemen, till next time, use your difference to make a difference.
You've just been listening to the As Told by Nomads podcast. For more ways to reach out to Tayo and to use your difference to make a difference, head over to www.tayoroxon.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time.
That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.